Good evening. Welcome to Labor Radio, the only program of its kind in Oregon and Southwest Washington. I'm your host, Bill Zimmerman, Teamsters Local 206. A few weeks ago, I received an email of a flyer that started with, "Are you tired of low wages, inadequate health care, housing that is unaffordable and unavailable, crumbling public school buildings and overcrowded classrooms? Tired of politicians who keep trying to undo our minimum wage and overtime laws that are supposed to protect us on the job? Tired of political parties that promise to fix these problems but never deliver on those promises? Well, so are we." Well, I got to tell you, folks, that flyer was like music to my ears, though it did raise some questions like, in 2004, did you hope John Kerry would win in November, even if he disappointed us in January? Or in the 2000 presidential election, did you feel like you wasted your vote just to send the Republicans and the Democrats a message? Do you hold your nose while you're trying to vote for Ron Wyden because of his yes votes on free trade policies? Or do you feel powerless during the election cycle knowing that some, if not most, politicians will say or do anything to get elected and then forget those promises? Why can't we have a political party that focuses on worker issues like health care, decent wages, pension, schools, or the Employee Free Choice Act? And why are worker issues not front and center during every election cycle? And how do we, as workers, hold politicians accountable? Later in tonight's program, we'll be talking to Mary Winzig, ILWU Columbia River organizer, and Charlie Finger, a McCall Oil worker, on their unanimous ratification of their first contract. We'll also be talking to Dan Cantor, executive director of Working Families Party out of New York State. But first, here in the studio is Barbara Dudley. Barbara is a teacher at PSU and a tireless activist. Barbara, welcome to Labor Radio.
Thanks, Bill.
So, Barbara, why don't you tell us a little bit about your past activities so people know who we're talking to here. Now, you were in League of Women Voters, correct?
I am a member of the League of Women Voters, although that's just been since my hair turned gray, I think. I have been a labor lawyer. I worked with farm workers in California.
You were also president of the Guild, right?
I was also president and executive director of the National Lawyers Guild for 5 years. And then I also was the director of Greenpeace USA for a 5-year stint. Okay. I seem to have 5 years in my life.
So you seem to bring a little bit of weight to this table tonight, especially on this subject. So, Barbara, are workers getting tired of politicians not delivering on worker issues? And also, I got to ask you, are politicians just not promising anything to workers anymore because we've gotten so far away from that issue?
Well, I think what's happened, really, is that both of the major political parties have decided that their bread is buttered, literally, by major donors, both corporate and individual, and so they pay much more attention to the needs of those people rather than to the working people whose votes they get.
Right. Like, I mean, Democrats, for example, I think they get their votes in one place and their money in another place, and there's kind of a conflict of interest of those two places?
Yes, well, that would be fairly accurate,
okay.
Yes.
So what do you think we should do?
Well, what we're doing here in Oregon is basically following the lead of the Working Families Party in New York. And you will be talking later, I know, in the program to Dan Cantor, who's the director and one of the founders of the New York Party. So he can tell you some of that, but just to let you know, the party there started just in 98. It hasn't been around that long, and the point of it was to focus entirely and solely on issues of concern to working families, hence the name, the Working Families Party. And those kinds of issues are things about living wages, minimum wage, holding the minimum wage at least the level where a family can survive, having decent public schools, having affordable housing, having health care affordable and universally available. And, as you mentioned earlier in the show, the trade agreement problem, a lot of the incentive for working people, I think, to take a hard look at the Democrats is that they have brought us, I mean, we really do have to place the blame where it belongs, they have brought us these trade agreements which have been so very, very damaging to the livelihood of workers in this country.
Absolutely. So what you're seeing is that you want to model the Working Families Party in New York State because of their success in just a short period of time.
Exactly.
So Working Families Party, first of all, here's what I'm thinking. Most of us either have a job or want to have a job or just had a job or retiring. So that's something that I think almost everyone in this state has in common. So right off the bat, I kind of like the way it sounds. But your issues are narrowly defined. You're just looking at workers' issues. I mean, what about stuff like choice or gay and lesbian issues or gun control or any of that other stuff?
Well, we are focusing on economic issues. And to the extent that choice around reproductive choice is an economic issue, it will be an issue that we will focus on. As I'm fond of saying, whether you're going to have an abortion or have a baby, you better have health care. And I think, you know, most women know that the majority of women who choose to have an abortion do so because they can't afford another child. And so we're looking at working families issues by saying we have to create a situation where people are not making difficult choices that they're making solely because they can't afford to choose something else. We want living wages. We want family wages for families. And that's the primary issue. And we want health care for every working family.
So how did Working Families Party get here to Oregon? Has it started? You know, how long you've been discussing this? Let's talk a little bit about what's happened up till this date.
Well, we have been discussing it for 2 years at least. And the conversation in Oregon, anyhow, picked up considerably last summer when the AFL-CIO split happened. Mm-hmm. Because I think what happened, and this was true in other states, because there are other states also having the conversation about starting a Working Families Party. And I think what happened was the split amongst labor unions made everybody sort of step back and say, oh my God, what have we done now? Our political strength has been dwindling and dwindling and dwindling basically since, the New Deal era. And yet here we are splitting the few resources that we have. So clearly we need a place to consolidate our political resources and our political wisdom and our money so that we can actually have an impact on the political process. And so that was the real spur of activity here in Oregon. And it's also happening in Washington State, Missouri, Ohio, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and believe it or not, South Carolina. So this conversation is happening in a lot of places. The thing, though, that's important to know is that the reason it started in New York State is because in New York there's a voting system in place that used to be in place also in Oregon, and in fact in every state in the union, called fusion voting, which allows a minor party to nominate the same candidate as a major party. So that the Working Families Party, when it began in New York, began with this voting system in place, which people were very used to in New York. There had been very active minor parties doing a lot of cross-endorsing. So it gave the Working Families Party the option of nominating a Democrat or a Republican even if that person accepted the platform of the Working Families Party. If there was no decent candidate from the two major parties, then you run your own candidate as a standalone candidate. But if there was somebody who you thought might represent your issues or who you could hold accountable, then you could nominate that person.
Okay, so let me back up here for a moment because I think we threw a lot out in just a short period of time. So this is a two-part deal.
Two-part strategy, that's
right. What we're seeing is that we need a third party in this state, and I want to talk about that a little bit more. But for that third party to have any political clout, then we also need to introduce this fusion voting.
That's our feeling on the subject. There's other things happening in this state, though, which make this a very interesting year. One of the things that I think is sort of a sleeper issue, but that's going to have a whole lot of impact on working people is this push for what's being called an open primary. It's not technically speaking an open primary, but the thing that Phil Kiesling and Ben Westlin and others are pushing, which would essentially set us up to have two general elections rather than a primary that's a party-run primary and then take your candidate from your party to the general election. What they're talking about doing is changing the voting system here so that you have a free-for-all in the primary, and then you take your two top vote-getters, and they could be two people from the Republican Party or two people from the Democratic Party or whatever. You take them to the final general election. That could have a huge impact as well, and how that would interplay with this thing I'm calling fusion voting is really a complex question that everybody is sort of studying right now.
So that's instant runoff is kind of what you were
It's talking. Not instant runoff per se. An instant runoff, I mean, this may be just a little too wonkish for your listeners, but bear with me because it is going to impact our lives. Instant runoff, which is what has been proposed by the Green Party and others, is that you, on your ballot, you list your first choice candidate, and then your second choice candidate, and then your third choice candidate. If your first right. choice candidate isn't one of the top two, your vote instantly gets triggered to the second choice candidates. It's a fairly complex voting system. Open primary is not that. Open primary is everybody who wants to run for governor is in one primary. So you have Kevin Mannix, and you have Ron Saxton, and you have Ben Westlin, and you have Ted Kulongoski, and you have Pete Sorensen, and you have Hill, and you have the rest of them all on one ballot. And we vote in this primary in May, and we pick, you know, we've just vote for our first choice. Then you end up, you going to the general election with the two top vote getters from that primary.
And regardless of who they are.
Regardless.
What party.
Precisely. So it could be Mannix and Saxton go to the general election, and those are your last two choices. That's all you can choose from. So this one's coming along and has a very good chance of passing unless people kind of wake up and say, wait a minute, what kind of impact is this going to have?
Right. Well, in the main election, you could be voting, even if it's two Democrats. To me, that's not an election. I got a problem here, you know. But that's not what we're talking about here.
No.
In fusion voting, and again, I want to get back to this. This is a two-piece punch, I guess you could say. You want to start a third party.
And we want it not to be what's called a spoiler party.
Okay.
We don't want it to be a wasted vote. We want to have a party where people join the party, where working people come together and say, okay, we're going to form our platform. These are the things that are going to matter to us most in the year 2006 or the year 2008. This is what we're going to get past this year. And so you agree, you build your platform, and then you bring in the candidates and say, will you support our platform? Because if you will, we will give you our nomination, and you can run on our party line. And if you then abandon that platform, if you screw us later, we're going to run a candidate against you.
Right. So in the traditional sense of a third party, that's not what we're talking here, because a third party you have to, and I mean, I'm sure under Working Families Party, you have to go raise money and be a viable party and all that. But the Working Family Party and Fusion, okay, you could... I'm just going to run this out there.
Sure.
Tell me where I'm wrong in this, okay? You have an election. You have a Democrat and a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And I can go to that election, and I can vote for the Democrat or for the Republican. But what you're saying is you want to introduce a third party, and you want to introduce fusion voting. And how this ties together is now I can vote for that same person as a Democrat, or I can vote for that same person on the Working Party's family line.
Yes.
And those votes on Working Family Party line will count the same as if I voted on the Democrat line. So then what's the difference?
So you tally those votes separately, and then you add them together. So the difference is that candidate then knows what percentage of his vote came from the Working Families Party. So he knows that the people who voted for him on the Working Families Party line care most about those issues, and he knows that the margin of difference, hopefully, came from the Working Families Party voters. So he will then feel beholden to those voters. As opposed to today, where working people all over the place are voting for the Democrats, holding their nose and voting for the Democrats, and then having the Democrats turn around and say, we don't need to worry about your issues because you have nowhere else to go.
So this is a way to hold politicians accountable. I think I like this.
Precisely. That's exactly.
So in other words, I could have voted for, let's say, Mary Smith as a Democrat, and my issue could be whatever my issue is, and Mary Smith really doesn't know what my issue is. She just knows that I voted for her as a Democrat.
That's right.
But I could also, under fusion voting, vote for Mary Smith as a Democrat under the Working Families Party, and now Mary Smith knows that I care about wages, I care about health care benefits, I care about schools. Those are my primary concerns.
Right. And if Mary Smith doesn't stick with those issues, then next election, you run someone against her as the Working Families Party candidate because you have your own ballot line.
Okay. So again, this holds politicians totally accountable, and they're going to look at that 8 or 10% on Working Families Party, which may be the difference in them winning or losing the vote. And now they know it's because of people with these issues. So now they're elected, they're in place. So then what happens when they start to stray away from working issues?
Happens is you go marching in there and you say, remember us, we're the ones who elected you, and you better pay attention to those issues, or in the next election, we're going to run a candidate on our own party line. We're going to run against you.
So now when something like the Employee Free Choice Act comes up, Mary Smith is going to have to take a real hard look at this and not say, oh, I can take all these people for granted. No, I'm going to have to vote.
That's exactly right.
Yes.
And
isn't that, you know, I know some people are out there saying, because I got to tell you, I went up to some blogs on this Working Families Party and infusion voting, and there seemed to be some people not real happy about it, let me put it that way. But also, I got to tell you, as I read through those blogs, I think those people did not truly understand what the two pieces of this puzzle were.
Right.
The Republicans, they just did the same thing with their issues. I mean, they got their voters out on single issues. And so, I think one of the problems that a blogger had was that Jesus is going to take my choice away. I don't see how it takes a choice away. I see this as adding to your choice, because now you're almost like voting twice. You're voting for the candidate and for your issues.
Yes, that's exactly right. There are several objections to this, but I think all of them sort of fall away when you actually have a chance to explain to people what's going on. Well, not all of them. I'll get back to that in a second. But one of the objections is that you are, instead of helping to build the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, you are taking energy away and putting it into a third party. Well, with fusion voting, what you're doing is truly building a progressive wing of the Democratic Party, because those people, those who represent our issues, are going to be getting the nomination of the Working Families Party. Mm. So that's one thing that I think when people understand fusion, they get that. There is another group of people who object to this who are more sort of tied to the Democratic Party, but who are uncomfortable with the idea that they're going to be held accountable on working family issues. There are an awful lot of Democrats who are happy to take union money, but really, in the end, they don't want to have to stand up for union issues.
Absolutely. You know, and that's been one of my complaints all along is, you know, I know in our union, we have a process. We bring in politicians, ask them what they think on these subjects, and then if they answer all the questions correctly, we write them a nice blank, and we write them a check, hand them the check, they take off, they cash the check, spend the money, get elected, and then it's like, you call them up and you say, well, we really need your support here, and they go, who are you?
Yeah.
They kind of forget about us. And if this helps hold them accountable to my issues, tough.
Yeah, yeah.
And just, why don't you just, like, do what you promised to do? in the first place. So again, if you're just joining us, we're talking to Barbara Dudley on the Working Families Party and fusion voting. I think it is a little bit of a complicated issue, so I may want to get a little repetitive here.
Let me just say one thing,
sure.
Bill. For people who want to delve into this a little bit more, we do have a website, and there's a lot of information there about fusion voting and how it works and the history of fusion voting in Oregon, because it used to be legal here and worked very effectively, which is, of course, why they made it illegal. You can learn a lot about fusion, and you can learn about the Working Families Party, and you can sign up to be part of our effort. That's at www.oregonwfp.org.
That's Working Families Party.
Right, okay. Oregon WFP.
So again, folks, and I just want to be real clear, and we do have Dan Cantor on the phone. We'll be getting to him in just a moment. We are talking to Barbara Dudley about Working Families Party and fusion voting. It's two pieces. One is a third party, Working Families Party. They're kind of narrow, I guess I'll say, in their issues. Pension, wages, health care, good schools,
yes.
Things like Employee Free Choice Act, anything that helps workers,
yes,
is what your focus is and what you would support.
Exactly.
Then you can take that as a Working Families Party, and you can endorse either your own candidate or another candidate, probably traditionally a Democrat, because they're the ones that supposedly care about working family issues. And you will have two lines on the ballot. One, you can vote for the Democratic candidate just as a Democrat, or then you can vote for the Democratic candidate, if endorsed by the Working Families Party, on the Working Families line. That sends the message to that candidate that, hey, we just gave you 10% of your vote. You owe us 10%.
Exactly.
And if you don't live up to your promises, we're going to withhold that 10% the next time.
Yep, and take it to our own candidate. That's exactly right.
Okay. So, and on the phone, we have Dan Cantor, Executive Director of New York State's Working Families Party. Dan, welcome back to Labor Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dan, we've been sitting here talking to Barbara Dudley about Working Families Party and fusion voting, and I know it's kind of a complicated issue, and some people may have a hard time getting past the fact that it's a third party, and, gee, we've been down the third party road, and traditionally third parties have a hard time. I think the election process is rigged against third parties.
Sure.
And with all of that said, Barbara mentioned that in New York since 1998, you've been working, or you've had a Working Families Party, and you've used it with fusion voting. How successful has that been?
Well, we're very pleased with what we've been able to do because we have this different voting system in New York than you have in Oregon. Although, I guess, as Barbara pointed out, you used to have it in Oregon. we've been able to cross-endorse or fuse, use the fusion vote with about 2,300 times in different elections, local, city, county, state level, and federal elections, in which the Working Families Party in New York, you know, usually cross-endorses a Democrat, occasionally cross-endorses a Republican, and sometimes we run our own against the two major parties when they put up two dogs. There's nothing fancy to it. It's just a slightly different system that solves the big problem that you've alluded to. The big problem for third parties in the American system is the wasted vote and the spoiler problem. Most people are not fools, and if you say, well, I want you to vote for a candidate with no chance of winning, they'll say, well, you seem like a nice guy, but I'm not interested in that. So we don't want to ask people to waste their vote on noble but doomed candidates. We want them to spend that precious vote, which is as precious as, you know, their time and their money and so on, even more so. We want them to apply that vote in a way that makes more sense. In a sense, like you were saying, it's like voting twice, once for the candidate and once for the party, or once for the values and issues of the party. That's the beauty of the system. So it allows people to say, well, I'm voting for Bill, but I'm voting for him on the WFP line, you know, to really send a message. And it works. Every elected official pays attention to how many votes they get on what line, and they're nervous. And a nervous elected official is our best friend.
So let me ask you, Dan, as and you've been in this process for a while and you've been successful at it, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. When these politicians see that they're getting 8, 10, 12% of their vote or even more from the working family's party line, does that bring working family issues closer to the front of the discussion? And have Democrats, which I guess is mostly what would endorse this, have they honed their message on working family issues because of this?
The short answer is absolutely yes. Now, it's not a magic feather or a magic bullet. You still have to organize. You know, we've had candidates where we've delivered 10 and 12 and 15 and 17%, and sometimes 3 or 5. And the candidate will, pass lip service, even though we've delivered a good chunk of their vote. We still need to remind them constantly and organize and do the flyering and the leafleting and the delegation visits to remind them of where their vote came from. But it gets a lot easier, and in many cases, the good candidates, whether they're more commonly Democrats, but occasionally there are some decent pro worker Republicans still. They kind of like it. They're able to say, I want to do this, and this helps me get it done, because I need to be attentive to those feisty WFPers who brought certain hundreds or thousands of votes to me, and so if they're pushing a health care, a big fair share for health care bill or minimum wage or fair taxation or school investment. These are the kinds of things we care about. We think that, middle class and working class families all over the country care about. And if you have a way for a voter to express themselves, right, most people don't have time to come to meetings. They're busy. They're stretched to the limit. But if they can at least vote, and if you can have that vote carry more meaning so that when you pull that WF lever or fill out that WFP box, as I think you do in Oregon, it has a little more oomph to it. Voters like it, and elected officials pay attention. And we find that the elected officials are much more interested in talking to us than before.
I was going to ask you, because I know you've been at this for quite a while, and I mean, here we are in Portland, a big town city here, and I'm not quite so sure that mainstream media would pick this discussion up and put it on the evening news. It's probably why we're discussing it here at our community radio station at KBOO. How has mainstream media responded to Working Families Party that's been in place for a while and is having some successes?
Well, in the beginning, you're totally correct. In the beginning, they were, somewhere between disinterested and dismissive. There would be a little squib in the paper. Well, there's a new effort to build another third party in New York. But over the last 7 years, the party was formed only in 1998, close to 8 years now. Over these years, the party has developed, I think, a pretty good reputation for being quite principled, for really focusing, and for being very effective electorally. We don't just try to provide, this is an important piece, it's not just about providing the margin of victory in the general election, although that's crucial. We also try to give the most progressive candidate our endorsement early so that they might get a leg up inside the Democratic Party primary, for example. If there are 4 or 5 candidates running and one of them is the consensus, good guy or good woman, progressive candidate, and the WFP and its community affiliates and labor affiliates says, this is the one we're backing, well, having that endorsement, we call it our seal of approval. We want voters who don't have much time to collect a lot of information about candidates, especially down-ballot candidates, to have confidence that the WFP seal of approval means something. And in fact, we've done if there's one thing we've done a good job on, it's that. And there's been some interesting polling back here in New York, which the WFP endorsement is now the most trusted endorsement in the state, according to a poll that was done not long ago by a university here, ahead of, the New York Times and the Daily News. So we're quite proud of that. And we think it's because we avoid double talk. You know that if somebody has the WF line, the Working Families Party line and endorsement, it probably means they're for, universal health care. It certainly means they're for higher wages. It means they're for schools that work for everybody, not just the wealthy, and so on. You can imagine the list. It's not, you know, we don't claim that we're coming up with new stuff. We're just tremendously persistent, and having that ballot line gives us a way to amplify our voices so that voters and decision makers hear us.
It's a little after 6:30. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. If you're just joining us, I'm your host at Labor Radio, and we're talking to Barbara Dudley, a teacher at PSU, and also Dan Cantor from the Executive Director of Working Families Party out of New York City. So, Dan and Barbara, and again, I want to be a little repetitive here because I think this is kind of a little hard issue for people to kind of swallow right at one time. And I know it took me several times of looking at it and reading through blogs and hearing about it until it finally sunk in. Traditionally, well, let's go all the way back to the beginning. We're starting a new party called the Working Families Party, but mm-hmm. you also want to couple that with fusion voting. Barbara, why don't you just, in just a little bit, let's talk about Working Families Party in case somebody just joined us. And then, Dan, let's talk a little bit about fusion voting.
Okay. Where I will go with this, too, is to tell you what we've done to date. The Working Families Party, as we've been saying, is a party that's going to be focusing exclusively on economic issues. We have filed the papers to qualify the party as a minor party in the state of Oregon. It's a fairly simple process, and then we're in the process of collecting. We need 19,000 signatures from any registered voters in the state of Oregon. They can be in any party mm-hmm. or no party at all. And we're actually going to go for about 30,000 signatures just to be sure. But the legal requirement is about 19,000. And then we are a legitimate third party with a ballot line in the state of Oregon. The question then is, how do we avoid what Dan was talking about, which is, you know, how do we not become a spoiler party? How do we not become a party where, you know, we run very politically correct candidates, but your vote is wasted?
Right.
So that's where fusion voting comes in. So that's the twin strategy here that goes with forming the party.
Dan, you want to go over fusion voting again?
Very briefly. It's a system in which a candidate's name can appear twice on the ballot for two separate parties. So you can run Republican-conservative, let's say, or Democrat-working families. This is what happens in New York. And the voters, in a sense, get more information. They know that by casting a vote on the WFP line or the conservative party line, for that matter, that they're sending a message with their vote. The votes are tallied separately and then get added together. So Barbara's running Democrat, and you're the Republican opponent here, Bill. This is hypothetical. And Barbara, and Barbara is also on the WFP line in the same election for, let's say, state legislature. Election day rolls around, and she gets 40, you know, 3 as a Democrat, and you get 48 as a Republican. And the last 9% rolls in on the WFP line. The votes are tallied separately, Barbara said, but added together. So she wins 52-48. But if we're any good, the day after the election, we call her up and say, congratulations, Assemblymember-elect Dudley. And we're just calling to say we were serious about that affordable housing or that health care or whatever issue was important to us in making that endorsement. So it's a way, in a, obviously, to have your vote, in a sense, count a little bit more, not just for the candidate, but for the values and issues of the minor party with which you align yourself.
And let me just throw something in here too, Bill, because I think one of the things is that the whole notion of political parties has become so corrupted in this country. And we tend to think of ourselves as voting for a candidate rather than voting for a party. It doesn't mean anything anymore to be voting for a party because the candidates are not accountable to the party platform. What we're trying to do here is to create a party where the platform has some meaning and where we intend to hold the candidates accountable. We're electing people to represent our platform, not to go as individuals with basically a free blank slate of whatever it is they feel like doing when they get into office.
And we have a caller with a comment or a question. Hello, caller.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I had a question for Barbara.
Sure.
her strategy or the outline strategy of having a Democratic candidate be disciplined by supplying a candidate of her own party is something I would question. I would wonder how she would get some people to run, how she would actually get people to run for office. Right now, I understand there's a deficit on both the Democratic and Republican sides about generating candidates enough to even run for this year's election, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, caller. Barbara?
Well, I think that that is an issue, and it's why we would choose that option very rarely. I think it is difficult to get candidates to run, and obviously we need campaign finance reform, too. We would put that high on the agenda of the Working Families Party. But I think that what you will find is when you have a real party that actually has a platform that is developed by the members of the party and that people have a lot at stake in, that people will, if they feel the need, if, as Dan put it, the two major parties nominate two dogs, that we will actually be able to have people from within our own party rise to the occasion and run instead.
Well, I mean, also, you know, I go back to what we do in the Teamsters when politicians come looking for money, and we sit down and have a meeting and ask them about questions. And I think the important part here is you know, as a union member, if my union is supporting a candidate and giving money, which ours comes through Drive, then I want that candidate to be held accountable. And if that candidate can't sit down and tell me, Bill, when I get something on free employee free choice act or something to do with pensions or that, I'm going to be in favor of working people, then I really don't want that guy, you know, whether he wants to be on my party or not. So, I mean, I think that's a two-way street is the way I'm looking at it.
It is, though, a rare option, I think, to, and it has to be, to run your own candidate, because you will end up in very few cases with enough votes to actually knock the other two parties out of the box. And it is so difficult to get candidates and to raise money for candidates. So, you know, I know it's used rarely in New York, and I can guarantee you it would be used rarely here.
Dan, any comment?
No, I agree completely. We tend to do it in races where one of the major parties is not running somebody. So it's really, it's another two-way race. It's just between us and the Democrats, as opposed to Democrats and Republicans, or us and the Republicans, and the Democrats aren't running somebody. It's very tough. Not impossible. We've won two or three three-way races, but that's out of, you know, 2,300 races, so it's not the main event. We don't live in, you know, in Europe or South America or some other more advanced country. We live in a winner-take-all system, and so we're not interested in just, you know, getting 3% of the vote or 10% of the vote and not electing people. We want to exercise power here, and that takes diligence and patience and, you know, a real willingness to be disciplined.
Right, and I mean, this isn't a process that is just 100% successful overnight. You know, this takes time to build. If it catches on here, you know, it's been working excellent in New York, so now Oregon's taking a look at it. I know Barbara talked about other states that are taking a look at it. So, I mean, hey, it's part of the process, and it's certainly better than the process we have in place right now.
And it's a way to look beyond just the next election. One of the most frustrating things, I think, for all of us is this constant two-year cycle, or at best four-year cycle, where all we're doing is sort of running in place and waiting to see who the Democrats put up for us to vote for.
Absolutely. We also have another caller. Hello, caller. Go ahead.
Well, I've got some questions about fusion voting. Is this what we're calling the open primary?
No, it's quite different.
Because with the open primary, I think you're only going to get people with name recognition.
Right.
And money.
And any
right.
third-party person is not going to be able to get in.
I totally
right.
agree. And
right. I think
know
Barbara discussed this earlier in the program. It is, she talked about open primaries, and that's not what this is.
And when does the fusion voting happen? Because I've had to do a wee bit of housework in between.
Another reason you need a working family party.
Absolutely.
When does it happen? We would have to either get it through a ballot initiative or...
But is it a primary thing?
No,
or
no,
it,
no.
In the general.
In the general, that's correct.
That's
correct. Because basically what you would be saying is that the Working Families Party would be a minor party in the state of Oregon.
And they could run a Democrat if they wanted to. They could
precisely.
Run a Green, or they could run somebody.
Whoever
right.
supports Working Families issues
Would get their nomination.
Would get their nomination. But then when people looked at their ballot and they saw that that candidate was endorsed by Working Families Party, they would know that that candidate brings a certain, I guess, tool bag to those issues. And if those are your issues, and look, there's a lot of issues out there, and whatever your issues are your issues.
I still think it's kind of, you're only going to probably be putting up Democrats.
Not
and
entirely.
I think they've most likely been disappointing, and there is another third party that's getting momentum across the United States, and that's the Greens.
Damn.
Well, and I kind of feel like this is another scattering of energy.
Okay,
you know,
well,
that happens with the left.
Dan, could you...
There are many fine people in the Green Party. The difference here, respectfully disagree, is that you need to change the rules if you're going to really build a third party that can thrive over time. Green Party's been out there 20, 25 years now in America, and it's actually not really affecting actual outcomes. There's a lot of good people, and I have a lot of friends who are supportive of it. I think the experience of the Working Families Party in New York, and if you cast your mind back to your own state's history, the great accomplishments of the populace in Oregon were all fusion tickets. These were populist hyphen Democratic tickets that elected governors and congresspeople and state legislators and city council people all across the state, all across the Northwest for that matter. And there's a reason, as Barbara said, that it was made illegal. It was because it was a real challenge. So I think the caller is right that we need to cohere our energies, unite our energies. And I guess I just argue that people should look at the Oregon WFP website, I guess it's OregonWFP.org, to see if this doesn't make sense. We live here, and we have to abide by the laws here and the culture here, and this seems to make more sense.
Barbara, I know you have to leave in about 2 minutes to head off to another meeting. Why don't you talk, and Dan, I want you to stay on just for a moment, and I'll give you some time to close. Barbara, why don't you talk again about the petition...
Right.
And what's needed and volunteers and all that.
Absolutely. What we're doing is we are now collecting signatures to qualify the Working Families Party as a minor party in the state of Oregon. We need to collect some 19,000 signatures. You can get all of the instructions and everything on online at our website, which is OregonWFP.org. You can't download the petitions themselves from the website, but it will tell you how to get a hold of them, or if you can't come to Portland, if you're outside of the Portland area, we'll send them to you. So just go to the website and help us collect signatures for step one of what we hope will be some real serious political change in the state of Oregon.
Okay, and again, the petition is to get the Working Families Party, I guess, accredited as
qualified as a minor party. That's right.
And then the second step would be fusion.
To get fusion
and
voting.
I guess we'll have another show on fusion voting and how that happens.
We'll have at least one.
And then again, folks, I don't think it really dramatically changes the landscape of the voting, because if you want to vote Democrat, vote Democrat. If you want to vote Republican, vote Republican. If you want to vote Libertarian, Constitutional, Green, whatever you want to vote, go vote. What we're saying is, what Barbara is saying and Dan is saying is, if the Working Families Party endorses a candidate and you vote for that candidate on that line, that candidate now knows those issues are important to somebody in this state.
Yes. Exactly. Well put, Bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Barbara, and you better hurry off to your next meeting. So, Dan, we just have a few minutes here. I just wanted to give you a couple minutes to close. We talked about some of the successes in New York with Working Families Party.
Mm-hmm.
I know I talked to you about the minimum wage being raised because of the Working Families Party. And was that part of fusion voting also?
Yes, it certainly was. In which we had built enough power to persuade some recalcitrant state legislators to not only pass the minimum wage law, $2 an hour for almost a million people, but also to override the governor's veto. And I should point out that we got a Republican state Senate to do this. That is to say, these weren't just, friendly Democrats. These were Republicans, and they were persuaded by the value of our percentage of the vote that they needed to keep us happy. And that's a good thing. We're now launching a campaign. Actually, the launch is tomorrow up in Albany, which is, you know, our Salem. A very ambitious healthcare campaign to require that all companies in New York State that have at least 100 workers must provide very decent healthcare benefits, spending about $3 an hour per worker, per hour. So this is going to be a battle royale because, you know, every Walmart and Home Depot and Staples and Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's and you name it is going to be up in arms about this. But our view is everybody should have health care. And those that people, when these firms are free riding on other people, well, then the taxpayers are just picking it up.
Right. But here's the important thing, Dan. You're putting the discussion out in front where it
absolutely
needs to be. To me, that's important. And win or lose, and we all certainly hope you win. But getting that discussion out on the table, to me, is the first step in winning.
Yes, and having a political party bill is an unbelievably potent tool for launching those discussions because every reporter follows you, every elected has to pay attention, and voters get a way to register their support or their lack of support. But so far, so good. We've been on a steady trajectory, upward.
Okay, so Dan, you have a website in case people want to go and see what yours is all about?
Yes, you can get to ours, I'm sure, through the Oregon WFP website, or you can go right to the New York one, which is workingfamiliesparty.org. Hardly a surprise. So www.workingfamiliesparty.org or OregonWFP.org.
Well, Dan Cantor, Executive Director of the Working Families Party out of New York, I appreciate you taking time and calling in, telling us, some of the successes and what you've been able to accomplish with Working Families Party and Fusion Voting, a two-piece deal here.
I really appreciate your time, too.
Okay, thank you, Dan. I appreciate you. And, Ben, with that, could we go to the underwriting?
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by Ask Me Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.wf.
And welcome back to Labor Radio. I'm your host, Bill Zimmerman, and in the studio we have Mary Winzig, ILWU Columbia River organizer, and Charlie Finger, an employee at McCall Oil. Let's see, Mary and Charlie, maybe one of you. Charlie, you just went through an organizing drive, got to your first contract. Mary was kind of involved in that. I guess let me start with Charlie. What made you decide that you wanted to be in a union, and how did that process move forward?
Well, the decision was made after a considerable amount of time that we were tired of getting treated the way we were, which, just to make it simple, was pretty bad. And so we decided that the only way that we could really see effecting a change was to become a union. And so that's how we chose to do it.
And what made you decide to go to, you went to the Inland Boatmen's Union?
Right, the Marine Division of the ILWU.
And why did you go there? What was that?
Horsepower.
Horsepower?
That's right.
Well, I don't know. I can argue that. I'm thinking the Teamsters have a horsepower, but we'll get into that.
Okay, and the other part of it is that our trade is connected and would be well suited and integrated into that organization.
And what do you do in that trade? What's the main gist of McCall Oil?
Heavy oil and diesel as well. That's the light end of
it. So you're delivering like fuel to tankers and stuff like that?
And barges, and we have a dock, and we do it by truck.
So how many gallons does it take to run a tanker? A ship.
How many gallons?
Yeah.
Oh, it's in barrels.
Barrels. A lot of barrels?
A lot of barrels.
Okay. So, Mary, you get this phone call from these workers who are dissatisfied with their boss. I know that's hard to believe right out of the gate.
Shocking.
And so as an organizer, what happens from that step?
We pretty much had a bunch of meetings with the workers to find out what their issues were. And their issues were pretty consistent. Basically, they were getting treated badly on the job. They weren't being respected. They didn't have a voice. And they just decided they couldn't take it anymore. They also wanted more money, which most workers need and deserve. But, you know, we start out listening to the workers, finding out what they need, and proceed from there.
Okay. So now there's all these meetings going back and forth, and I suppose behind the scenes there's some cards being signed for union representation?
Actually, this group of workers were, the McCall workers were amazing. They stuck together from the beginning to the end. They signed 100% signed cards. We decided that we were going to march on the boss for recognition so we wouldn't have to go through a National Labor Relations Board election. 100% walked in the boss's office, presented a letter. They still didn't think these guys were serious.
The boss just didn't say okay. And
he just didn't turn over and just, you know, say, hey, welcome to the union. He decided to make us go through an election. They heard a few weeks of some anti-union rhetoric. And then they decided the election came, which was in March of last year, when Mount St. Helen blew up.
Mm.
They voted 100% for the union.
So Charlie, and excuse me a minute, Mary said that you marched in the boss's office. That must have been pretty empowering to walk into your boss and say, hey, we're dissatisfied with what's going here. And then she said that they had some non-union meetings and stuff. What was that like, and how did people take that?
Well, the company proceeded in a fairly low-key anti-union campaign. But nonetheless, they tried to convince us that we didn't really need to do that, that we didn't need a third party to intervene and just muck up a good thing.
But you didn't think it was a good thing?
No, actually, their anti-union campaign worked quite well. That's why the vote came in at 100%.
Well, that's pretty phenomenal, 100%, because usually after an anti-union campaign, I know you drop off, you know, many percentage points, and to start with 100% and walk out with 100% is, that's amazing, and I just want to say thank you to you and to your workers down there and to your union members down there, because that's a pretty phenomenal feat to do.
It was pretty amazing. And the one thing that the workers also realized is that we were not a third party. They were the union. They were making the decisions. And so every time that the boss kept saying that, they just basically laughed.
So the union's not a building downtown that's making decisions. The decisions were being made right there amongst the workers.
Exactly.
Okay. So we have this worker calls the union, a union goes and has the meetings, and there's this letter in the march on the boss, and then these anti-union, and you have the vote, and the vote is 100%, and then the boss gives you the contract, right?
Wrong.
Okay.
Meanwhile, we go into...
Oh, the labor laws in this country.
Oh, they're just a joy to deal with.
Absolutely.
Joy to deal with. So then we started bargaining. Charlie was on the bargaining team along with Vicki Wintheiser. And they still did not believe that these guys wanted to go union.
And I'd like to interject that,
sure,
that we wrote the original proposal. We would meet every Thursday, and people would come by, and we were taking notes, and we put this entire package together.
So what you're saying is your contract, the thing that you're going to live by for the next X amount of years, was from people coming in and voicing opinions and bringing in suggestions.
Absolutely.
And filtering all that down and figuring out what works and what doesn't
work. Right. The initial proposal that was thrown down on a table was put together by us.
So you go through this process, and you take this into the negotiating meeting, and then the boss gives you the contract, right?
Wrong.
I'm seeing a trend here.
Yes, there's a little bit of a trend here. Basically, they kept saying that we really didn't have a voice for these workers, that this is not what the workers needed or wanted, even though the workers would continually come to the negotiations and tell them, you know, to their faces that this is what they wanted. They would sign various job actions that they would do to prove it. At one point, the boss said they didn't want a union shop, so we had everybody sign up saying they wanted a union shop, which was really powerful. The next day we got it. I mean, to me, it was just such a beautiful...
You got it in negotiations.
In negotiations.
And what we're talking about, folks, is union security. You can have an open shop, or you can have a shop where you have to belong to the union. You have 100% of the people voting for the union. What was he thinking? that you'd even want to even talk about an open shop. But so you do the event. Everybody signs it. You go back into negotiations. What choice does this boss have?
I think they were starting to. The one really interesting thing about this whole process too is that the boss, I don't think, was really in it for the long haul. I think he kept thinking that we would just go away, that these workers would get tired of this process, that they could stall it out longer. The workers would just say, oh, I just don't want to do this anymore. And the workers, time and time again, just showed McCall Oil that, no, this is what they wanted, and they were going to fight for it.
Right. And so speaking of fighting for it, you're in negotiating your contract. You're not getting too far. So, Charlie, the beginning of December of last year, you decided to take action and show the boss just exactly how serious you were. What did you do?
We had our ULP strike.
You want to explain that a little bit?
Yeah, we had filed with the National Labor Relations Board that the company was breaking labor law and their failure to negotiate in good faith, and many other issues surrounding that. And we got... if I remember right, I think it was seven. Yeah, we got seven complaints issued against them. And so we decided that since that wasn't making enough of an impact on them, that we was going to use the labor law as it still exists and that we could go out in a lawfully sanctioned strike and voice our disapproval of their actions. And we did. We had a 36-hour ULP strike against them.
And, Mary, how successful was that strike?
The strike was so amazing. It was just such a rockin' strike. We had the workers walked out at 12:01 on a Monday morning. There were about 100 people waiting outside the gates for them. We had drummers. We had Jobs of Justice. We had Teamsters. We had SEIU, AFSCME, Musicians Union, ILWUs, Local 5, Local 8, Local 40.
Solidarity.
We had solidarity, and I think it just really bolstered the workers, knowing that here they are, they're only 11 workers, they're out in the middle of bum front row avenue out there, and, you know, and here's 100 people out there waiting for them.
At midnight.
At midnight, and it was cold.
In December.
In December.
On the waterfront.
On the waterfront.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing, and... we continued it on for 36 hours. The workers once again voted 100% to go out on the strike. 100% they walked the picket. They did not cross the line. We were able to turn back a lot of trucks, a lot of Teamsters trucks, of course, turned back. The railroad, you know, helped us out a lot. And we are actually able to turn back a lot of trucks who were not union because these workers had such a great working relationship with a lot of the truck drivers that they wouldn't cross the picket. And so it was amazing. And then right at the end on Tuesday, we got a call from the boss saying, hey, let's go back to negotiations.
He wanted to sit down and talk?
He wanted to sit down and talk.
I like that.
It was
that
amazing.
That sounds good. So we have about less than a minute left. How did the contract turn out and what was the vote from the workers? Charlie?
Well, we think the contract turned out very well. And it was ratified by 100%. So we took it all the way down the line from start to finish.
Great. Well, you know, this is not that often do we get to come in here with a great success story like this. Workers on the job decided they needed the union to help out, and it goes through the whole process, and we finally get there. Mary, you have about 10 seconds.
My favorite thing is the workers, when they were voting for the contract, they said, the reason we got this contract is because we went out doing direct action. Direct action got the goods.
Amen. Well, Charlie Finger, Mary Winzik, thanks for coming in and telling us about McCall Oil, its success there. Folks, I'd like to thank you for listening to this edition of Labor Radio and tune in next week. Thank you.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by AFSCME Local 3336, representing the employees of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality by advocating for working conditions, pay and benefits, supporting political activity that promotes pro-environment and pro-labor positions, strengthening labor coalitions, and actively organizing members. More information at AskMe3336.org.